Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. Today's episode is about Joe Ganane, a drug addict. It's hard to say any more, as drugs consumed his world. But when this hopeless junkie took a life, the law would ask a very valid question. Who was responsible for the murder? Was it Joe's fault or his drugs? Murder Mile is researched using authentic sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 140, The Diminished Responsibility of Joe Ganane. Today, I'm standing on the corner of Greek Street and Romilly Street in Soho, W1. One street southeast of the bombing of the Admiral Duncan pub. One street north of the epileptic bank robber Jack Esmond Murphy. And two streets southeast of the collapse of the Pawn King. Coming soon to Murder Mile. At 29 Greek Street sits the Coach and Horses, one of my favourite pubs. With a boozer situated on this site since the 1700s, it's kept many of its traditional aesthetics. Being a four-story, Grade II Victorian corner house, with white walls, an iconic red flash, and the ground floor chock-full of original features, like red steel pillars, tobacco-stained tiles, heavy wooden doors, and the old Taylor Walker lanterns. Made famous by the play Geoffrey Bernard Is Unwell, Norman, one of London's rudest landlords, and it is said the inspiration for Robert Louis Stevenson to write The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The Coach and Horses is a wonderfully honest old man's boozer, where you can sup a decent pint over a good old sing-song on the piano, all under a portrait of the Queen Mum. And yet if you ask nicely, you can be led upstairs to one of the city's best and most secret vegan restaurants. Recently acquired by a pub chain, thankfully they haven't ripped its guts out, but they have stripped out the sticky carpet and they've even fixed the toilets. So when weeing, no longer do you have to stare into a dank abyss of leaky pipes, stale piddle, possibly the plague, and mould so old it's gone a bit racist. Like most pubs, outside you may see the odd fight, mugging, flasher, and even the occasional murder. One such murder occurred just recently. It made the papers, but very few people paid attention to it. As being a tawdry tale about a junkie who killed a possible dealer over some drugs, nobody cared. In the public's eyes, They were two blights on society who had made their own decisions. One took drugs, one sold drugs, and they both chose to live a life of crime and to make fast money the easy way. But the trial would pose an interesting conundrum. If the attacker was high on drugs at the time of the murder, was he fully responsible for his own actions? Or were the drugs that he took partly to blame? As it was here, just before dawn, on Sunday the 3rd of March 2019, the Joe Ganane stabbed Mohammed Elni to death. But when did his rational decision-making stop and the drugs take over? The legal definition of diminished responsibility is an unbalanced mental state which makes a person less answerable for a crime and grounds for a reduced charge, but it does not classify them as insane. There are three factors to determine a person's diminished responsibility. If they couldn't understand the nature of their conduct, if they couldn't form a rational judgment, and if they couldn't exercise self-control. All of which could be affected by learning difficulties, disability, trauma, disease, drink, or drugs. Joe Derek Ganane was born on an unspecified date in February 1985 to a mother whose surname was May and an unidentified father in the South London borough of Lambeth. And that's as far as the press would delve into his past. Described as evil, on paper, this 34-year-old was the epitome of a drug addict. Dark ringed eyes, a broken nose, messy brown hair, and a tired, pasty face dotted with spots. His childhood was a dark, depressing muddle of abandonment, isolation, fear, rejection, and hopelessness. And although a lethal cocktail of drugs was his one constant to escape from the horrors of his life and to erase the pain of his past, he wasn't uneducated or unintelligent. Seven months after his arrest, whilst incarcerated at HMP Whitemore, Joe's poem, titled An Odour Was All It Took, a brutally honest insight into his life, won Poem of the Month in Inside Time, a prison magazine, and it later won the 2020 Pinter Poem Award, a prize for poets in prison. The smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, drug despair. Oh, how I wish I was there. School in the morning, football in the afternoon, painted circles adorned the walls of my room. Two cats and an apple tree in the garden. I struggled to place my memories. My memories have made my emotions harden. Self-reflection, soul inspection, toilet, spoon, injection, adolescent withdrawals, a brought erection. An outpouring of pain, shame, all aboard the thought train. The smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, before prison, a colourless prison. Memories out of sync, anachronism, football stickers, foil, pipe, light flickers, Soho-bound city slickers. Dark days, bright nights, a young moth down the Piccadilly lights. A corner huddled, seeking oblivion, memories muddled, a fruitless pursuit trying to clasp a puddle that bubbled. An outpouring of pain, shame, all aboard the thought train. The smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, before I made my mother cry, earthbound yet seeking the sky. My passage resides in a cling film package. Emotions, memories, abandoned baggage. Blackheath fireworks displays, fairies sprinkling dust on school plays. The good old days. before me and Innocence parted ways. Waifs, strays, a cup in hand, homelessness pays. An outpouring of pain, shame, all aboard the thought train. The smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. The time before care, before fear, despair, a shed tear, stealing from those I hold dear, near. My breaking point. Suicide, life, what's the point? Institutionalized. At home in the joint, at home with a joint, freedom bound to disappoint. My cause rotten, I should be forgotten. An outpouring of pain, shame, last stop for the thought train. By the age of 13, when most boys were playing with their PlayStations, Joe's home life was fractured. He was living in care. He had been abused, and he was addicted to heroin and crack. Living on the streets and surviving on handouts, the only constants in his depressing little existence was drugs and prison. With a criminal history of 16 counts of theft, robbery, and violent assault, Joe was in and out of prison throughout parts of his adult life. And although incarceration would provide him with a bed, clean clothes, and 3 square meals a day, it posed a problem for someone so reliant on drugs. Joe was addicted to 3 drugs: heroin, crack, and spice. Heroin enveloped him with feelings of euphoria, with a hit like being wrapped in a cotton wool cocoon where nothing could harm him. But the pleasure would be short-lived and followed by a toxic mix of short and long-term symptoms like nausea, vomiting, itching, abscesses, insomnia, confusion, cramp, constipation, collapsed veins, organ failure, mental illness, anxiety, depression, sexual dysfunction, and irrational thoughts. With the only way to suppress the side effects being to inject more heroin. Like many addicts, Joe also used crack cocaine to counteract the effects of the heroin. It gave him a quick high, hyper-alertness, increased strength and energy, but only for 30 minutes. Like heroin, the side effects of crack cocaine were severe, including insomnia, confusion, aggression, anxiety, paranoia, and hyper-excitability, which clouded his rational thoughts, as well as coke bugs, a vivid hallucination that insects were burrowing into his skin. With the only way to suppress the side effects of crack being to smoke spice. As a psychoactive cannabinoid, spice relaxed him. But again, being a short-lived high, it led to sweating, palpitations, vomiting, irritability, extreme violence, suicidal thoughts, an irrational distrust of other people, and auditory and visual hallucinations. So vivid, he couldn't tell reality from fiction. To suppress the side effects of spice, he took heroin. And so the vicious cycle would begin again. On Friday the 1st of March 2019, whilst a remand in police custody and awaiting trial on the charge of robbery at Highbury Magistrates Court, although he had made up with his mother and he could have gone home to stay with her in Plumstead, he didn't. Although he could have collected his prescription for methadone to assuage his drug addiction, he didn't. And although he should have gone and stayed at his bail hostel, he didn't. As Judge Richard Foster would later state, you made a conscious decision, a bad decision, to go to Soho. Joe Ganane had been a drug addict for more than 20 years, almost 2/3 of his life. As a homeless man, used to being attacked and stabbed by strangers, he often carried a large kitchen knife. As a junkie just out of prison, he was suffering from withdrawal as he headed into Soho in search of a fix. And although many of the bad decisions were entirely his, one was out of his control. As just 36 hours before the murder, Joe was released on conditional bail. On the evening of his release, CCTV cameras would record Joe in and around Old Compton Street in Soho. A vibrant, frenetic place of fun, festooned with a kaleidoscope of clubs, bars and cabarets. But seen by some as a series of squalid streets of sin, Soho also has a very dark side, courtesy of drugs and poverty. Whether day or night, it's a regular occurrence to see shambling drunks stumbling towards their next swig, heroin addicts collapsed in a matted heap, constipated crack addicts relieving their rotten guts in a doorway, and sometimes it's impossible to sup a pint without being accosted by the deluded. For the jury at Joe's trial, it was very simple. He had made the decision to go into Soho in search of drugs. He knew the risks, he took the chance, and over the next 36 hours, he binged on heroin, crack, and spice. Trapped in an all-too-familiar vicious circle of depleting highs and bigger hits, with his body used to this abuse, he staggered from fix to fix, losing the fight to counteract the side effects. And so a familiar tragedy unfurled. Score, euphoria, dip, stumble, collapse, inject, and repeat. On the wet and windy night of Saturday the 2nd to the morning of Sunday the 3rd of March, cameras witnessed Joe Ganane taking drugs alone and in the company of others, including 37-year-old Mohammed Elney. In court, Mohammed's family described him as a kind, jovial and cheeky son, who was the eldest of four siblings, paved the way for us in our new environment, a protector in a new country and life. As a devoted father to two boys, aged 7 and 9, he provided as best he could, given that his options were cut short following a traumatic brain injury in an unprovoked assault. It remains unproven whether Mohammed was just a user or a supplier. A fact his family dispute, stating he was not a drug dealer, he had qualified as a plumber. But in court, Joe grew increasingly unhappy, barking, "The geezer's making it up as he goes along. Sentence me now, I'm sick of him." Joe's erratic, paranoid behaviour did him no favours, even as his own defence, Edward Henry QC, tried to put across that Joe was a broken, bewildered, and also deeply troubled individual, unaware of Mr. Elney's vulnerability. But when Joe's poem, "An Odor Was All It Took," was read aloud in the court to give context to his drug-taking and his troubled past, Joe stormed out, cursing, "I don't need to listen to this bollocks." He spat at a dock officer and shouted, "That is what I think of your court." After 2 decades' exposure to illicit drugs, a lifelong history of abuse, homelessness, hunger, assault, mental illness, and a default emotional setting which was stuck at paranoid, Joe trusted no one. In the early hours of Sunday the 3rd of March 2019, 36 hours into his drug-fueled binge, Joe unsteadily staggered through the dark-lit back streets of Soho. His stumbling feet were as unbalanced as his mind. Shortly before dawn, a nasty drizzle engulfed the air, a fine thick mist which soaked everything, as a chilly wind made Joe's jacket as wet as it was heavy. Several times, Joe and Mohammed were seen together, meeting many times for minutes and sometimes for seconds. At any time, Joe could have decided that enough was enough, but he didn't. He could have dumped the large kitchen knife that he'd stashed in his jacket, but he didn't. And having run out of money for drugs, he could have left for his hostel, perhaps to pick up his prescription for methadone. But again, he didn't. But then again, who was in control at that point? Joe or his addiction? The short fix of euphoria was long since a distant joy, as a catalogue of symptoms swept through his ravaged body, fighting against each other like a junkie gauntlet to the death. Shivers, cramps, spasms, sweats, exhaustion, insomnia, high fevers, low chills, vomiting, confusion, palpitations and nausea. Spiralling out of control, the grim misery of addiction had taught him that no more drugs was not an option. He couldn't just quit, as withdrawal was worse than any death, a sickness worse than any sickness, as his symptoms would never die, only duplicate, unless he got one more hit of heroin, crack, or spice. At about 5:45 a.m., the streets were deathly quiet, except for the howl of amorous cats, the rumble of emptying bins, and the soft shush as street sweepers wipe away any trace of piss and glass, as the night's revelers slept soundly in their beds. But still, the junkies crept. Under the shadow of the Palace Theatre on Romilly Street, hunkered in the unlit doorway of the Coach and Horses pub, stood Mohammed Elney, dodging the drizzle and cold, as again Joe Ganane approached. Neither was a friend nor enemy, as with one needing the other, the two men remained on good terms. There was no falling out, no sore looks, no cruel words, no money owed, and no punches thrown. It was just as it had been for the last 36 hours. Without warning, Joe plunged the 12-inch kitchen knife through the jacket, two thick layers, and inflicted five separate 2-inch wide wounds into Mohammed's stomach, hip, and thigh. With no defensive cuts, the stabbing came silent and frenzied. Not out of hatred, but out of sheer desperation. As Mohammed slumped on the rain-soaked floor, focused only on a quick fix, Joe rifled the pockets of the dying man's puffer jacket, his feverish hands staining red as blood gushed from his failing organs and pooled around his graying frame. As Joe fled, he left Mohammed to die in the dirty, sodden gutter. By 11:35 a.m., with his new high having worn off and his ill-gotten gains all spent, Joe stabbed a 16-year-old drug dealer called Ahmed in an alley on University Street, just a few streets north. He stole drugs and money, but this time he didn't flee. When the police arrived, spotted acting suspiciously, he was challenged, he ran, he ditched the bloodstained knife and was swiftly detained. He confessed to both attacks and gave evidence in remorseless detail, crying, "How many times have I got to do this? I've stabbed loads of people. They won't die. I don't want to be here anymore." That day, 34-year-old Joe Ganane was charged with two counts of attempted murder, two counts of assaulting an emergency worker, and the possession, in public, of an offensive weapon. But who was responsible for these attacks? Was it Joe or his addiction? The trial of Joe Ganane began at the Old Bailey on the 23rd of September 2019, before Judge Richard Foster. Faced with all four charges, he admitted his guilt to the two lesser offences. He pleaded guilty to GBH with intent on 16-year-old Ahmed, but pleaded not guilty to Mohammed Elney's murder. Instead, he would plead guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. The evidence was self-explanatory. As without a shadow of a doubt, both the prosecution and the defence agreed that Joe had plunged a knife five times into Mohammed. Both sides agreed that Joe was an addict who suffered from a personality disorder. But whereas Dr. Farnham for the defence said that, owing to his addiction, his drug use was involuntary, and at the time of the killing, he was suffering from polysubstance dependent syndrome and cocaine psychosis. Thus, owing to the drugs, his responsibility was diminished. Conversely, Dr. Blackwood for the prosecution disagreed with how severe his disorder was and how dependent Joe was on drugs. Thus, his motive for murder, being robbery, was a conscious decision. This was the core of the jury's debate. What was a rational decision by Joe, an irrational decision by his addiction, and where did his decision-making deviate from voluntary to involuntary? If indeed they did. What was rational? Not staying with his mum, not sleeping at his bail hostel, rejecting his methadone, breaching his bail conditions, heading into Soho, seeking out drugs, or meeting up with fellow users. Was the nausea, the mistrust, the paranoia, the anxiety, the sweats, the cramps and the seizures, as well as his skewed perspective and the auditory and visual hallucinations all voluntary, given the fact that he had taken the drugs and that he knew the risks? Was the abuse he suffered as a child, the time he spent in a care home, his undiagnosed mental illness, and his life as an abandoned boy, struggling and starving on the London streets, did that diminish his responsibility and mitigate the severity of his crimes? Was the robbery and murder merely a logical step for a hopeless addict with 16 prior offences for theft and assault? Or was his mind simply mangled by a lifelong addiction to drugs? So complex was the case that the trial would take 2.5 weeks to complete. With the judge directing the jury, "Do not reach a conclusion until you have heard all of the evidence, in particular those by the psychiatrists." And yet, so confused would the jury become over exactly what constituted diminished responsibility that it almost derailed the case and led to a mistrial. Having heard Joe's own testimony, his poem, statements by Mohammed's family, and waded through a mountain of medical paperwork, after 3.5 hours of deliberation, on the 9th of October 2019, the jury returned with a unanimous verdict. Joe Ganane was found guilty of murder. Nothing less, with no lesser charge of manslaughter, and not on the grounds of diminished responsibility. He was sentenced to life, with a minimum term of 30 years to be spent in prison, meaning he will not be eligible for parole until November 2049. He is currently serving his sentence at HMP Whitemore in Cambridgeshire, where he wrote his award-winning poem, a poignant piece which mourned his past and predicted his future. My core's rotten, I should be forgotten. An outpouring of pain, shame, last stop for the thought train. Diminished responsibility is determined by three key factors. An inability to understand the nature of your conduct, to form a rational judgment, and to exercise self-control. But isn't that what drugs do? To erase the horrors of our real life, to free from the trappings of a rational world, and to enter the embrace of a place free from responsibility. Was Joe entirely guilty? You decide. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. As always, if you like listening to this podcast, there is some non-essential stuff after the break, where we sup a tea, maybe have a cake, and dive into some extra stuff about this case. It's not essential listening, and it might not be for you. So feel free to switch off now if you're not a fan of waffle. If you fancy treating yourself to some seriously good stuff, like a handwritten thank you card from me, a goodie pack of stickers, badges and fridge magnets, and maybe even a posh keyring, early ad-free episodes of Murder Mile, rarely seen crime scene photos, location videos, a weekly ebook, a secret podcast series called Walk With Me, back issues of Deadly Thoughts, exclusive merch. Oh yes, I've got more Reg Christie, Blackout Ripper and Police Constable Arsenal Guinness mugs on the way, as well as a new treat, a weekly video series called Cake of the Week. Ooh, it's the dirtiest kind of porn, where each week I share with you a tasty cakey treat. You can access all of these goodies by subscribing to the Patreon account for Murder Mile via the link in the show notes. And your subscription will help support this handmade podcast. Of course, you can also help by leaving lovely reviews and sharing this show with your friends. And that defeats the haters. Boo to them! Boo! I thank you. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
freaking long. That was a killer, that one. Holy moly. Moly, moly, pudding and pie. Kissed the girls and made them cry and all that. Oh, although I wouldn't make Eva cry. I'd only make Eva cry if I didn't get her cocktails on time. And I didn't clean her shoes and I hadn't ironed her dress. I hadn't done all my chores. That's what happens then. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Extra Mile. We're back. We're here. We're doing this. I'm just going to move my pop shield out of the way and all that. There we go. Just so I can go and pop on my hot water and make a cuppa. You're welcome to join me as well. Difficult time at the moment. I actually need a wee wee. But I don't think we're at that point in our relationship where I can have a wee wee whilst I'm doing Murder Miles. So I'm going to open up windows and doors, get some air in. Not too hot today. It's all right. Oh, dear. Nice, it's a nice cool day. We've got a week of it being relatively cool, which is lovely. So rather than sitting in here and dying and sweating, like in, was it last episode? I can't remember. Well, I think I may have sweated myself to death and it was horrible. Now it's really nice, it's really nice. I don't like the hot weather. Hot weather can go blow. I don't see the point in hot weather. I like it like this. It's about 20 odd degrees, maybe a bit less. A little bit cloudy. I'm making another coffee. Why am I making another coffee? I've no idea. This will be my third. Maybe that's it. I'll be a bit high. Sometimes if you come on a Murder Mile walk and I seem a bit hyper, it's normally because I arrived a bit late. I went into town, I grabbed a coffee, and it hasn't had time to settle, and I've gone a bit gaga. Sometimes that happens at the start, where I meet people and I'm a bit too talky. Or sometimes it's just because I live alone and I don't have anyone to talk at, except Eva. And Eva, basically, all she says to me is, "Where's my cocktail? And we need more sex, Michael." Oh, it's a hard life being Eva's boyfriend slash butler slash lover slash slave, mostly slave. What's going on in Mikey world? I'm trying to be good. I've had 48 hours without cake, carbs, fats, chockies or bickies. My only real treat is I have some quavers, but they're good because it's like a pack of quavers. It's like 80 calories, and you burn those off really fast, which is great. So I'm just trying to lose a little bit of weight because I'm a little. I know they say that quite a few people have put on like a stone or something over lockdown. I think I've put on everyone else's stone. So I've got a bit fat. Let's just check that I was recording. Yes, I am recording. Let's check I've got it on the right setting. Yes. Sometimes I realise I'm on the wrong setting. So that's all good. So I'm on a bit of a diet just so because I'm a little bit wibbly wobbly. Although Eva doesn't have a problem with that. She kind of likes, she doesn't say I'm fat. She says I'm good value. Because she purchased me as her slave. And because I'm a little bit big, she's like, you know, value for money. So that's a nice way to put it. I'm not fat, I'm just value for money. Or as I like to say, I'm not fat, I'm just getting ready to hibernate for winter. What else is going on in the world? I treat myself to a little £10 fan, £10, £15 fan, which is very nice. One of those, the problem with living on a boat is you can't plug stuff in. This is always a problem, that you can't plug stuff in. But I did treat myself to a little fan that I've got. I can't remember if I mentioned this last week. It's very nice. You plug it into your USB. It really cools down the room really fast. It's only tiny, but it cools down the room fast. It doesn't seem to circulate hot air. It seems to make its own cold air. It's magic. I don't know how it does it. I plug it into my laptop, and it doesn't seem to drain the power on the laptop, which is great. I thought it would be like, yeah, balls to you. I'm going to eat all your power. So it doesn't. So that was a bonus. I love that. What else is going on? Thank you to everyone who has recently added in some 5-star reviews online, and even better, people who've done more reviews. They've already done a review and they've done another one. As you know, sometimes I get mad people leaving negative reviews, and sometimes these mad people leave lots of negative reviews anywhere. And I've had one person who's weird has been saying that I'm a racist. I don't really understand that. I don't really know what's going on. She seems to be obsessed with the idea that in a couple of episodes I told people to wear a mask during a pandemic. Very weird. And has gone off on a rampage going, anti-British, classic nut job. So that loser has left negative reviews everywhere. But when I look at their past, they leave negative everywhere. And it does make you wonder how sad their life must be if all they have is negativity. So, just doing me coffee, coming over. Negativity. Yeah, it's like if I don't like things, I never leave negative reviews because I just think to myself, you know, at least someone's trying. At least they're trying their best. Or, you know, if I have some constructive criticism, I'll email them directly. I never leave it on a forum because I think some people need to question why they do that. Like some people go, enjoying your podcast, but, and it's always a but, and it's like, oh, here it comes. And it's just, why put it on a public forum? Why not just email the person directly and say, I think your podcast would be better like this? Negative reviews, I never leave negative reviews unless I feel that person absolutely deserves it. You know, if they're a nasty piece of shit, fuck them. Sorry about my bad language, but fuck them. If I think they deserve praise, god damn it, yes. I always go in and leave positive. And especially if it's a new podcast and they need a bit of help, I'm happy to do that as well. Because positive reviews are always good. But this person, core dear, I went through her, because luckily iTunes lets you go through what people have written before. Negative, literally one star, literally about everything. You can tell this person is not with it. So anyway, bizarre. What else are we doing? I'm meeting up with some friends. Today is Wednesday. I'm a day ahead of schedule. This was actually, the blessing was this was an easy episode to write because I kind of, the information was there. I knew what I wanted to say. And it took 2 days to write, which is a miracle for me because sometimes these episodes take 3 days. Sometimes you can take 5 days to write. I did it in two. And the great thing was I didn't skimp over everything. I felt it was nicely written. I might edit it down a little bit, but not too much. So that gives me time to go into town on Friday, the last Friday for you. I'm going to go and meet with some good friends at the Coach and Horses pub. What's the chance of that? Looking forward to that. So that's where we haven't met up in more than a year now, I would say. So I'm looking forward to meeting those cats. They're always good fun. Going to the Coach and Horses, it was there that we saw Jeffrey Bernard is unwell. We saw before the pub changed hands to Fuller's, we went to see Jeffrey Bernard is Unwell, which is a famous play written by a columnist and critic called Jeffrey Bernard. And it's based inside that pub, so it was lovely to watch. And we saw Robert Bathurst. It's only like space for like 50 people. We saw Robert Bathurst, who is Ed Houser Black in Toast of London. He was playing Jeffrey Bernard, and that was brilliant. That was really good to see. So it was very good. Last time, I was in that pub, I was with Police Constable Arsenal Guinness, who we are my people are in negotiations with his people for some dates where we can sit down and we record New Blue, which I'm very excited about. I'm drawing up my questions, and it'll just be drawing up some questions about what it's like, the daily life of being a copper on the beat, which I'm looking forward to. Hopefully that'll come out in October. And also it'll just be a nice chat for me and Police Constable Arsenal Guinness to sit down and just have a bit of a chat and a couple of pints, maybe. A couple of pints. So, quick swig of coffee. Oh, no cake this week. So as mentioned, I'm on a diet. But, as mentioned slightly earlier, on Patreon now, what I've started doing on Sundays is a little video called Cake of the Week, and it's a really close-up kind of look at the cake of the week, and I film it, and it's all nicely shot and all that. Even though it's done on my sofa, and it's slightly wonky, and the plate has got a little chip on it, it's fine. We do Cake of the Week, and then it's kind of a nice little video. So if you like cake and you like murder, please join Patreon. There's lots of different goodies on there that basically I won't share anywhere else, because it's basically Patreon has become a very good source of income. Advertising on the podcast isn't actually that good. It's not particularly great, whereas Patreon has kind of really, really has helped out and has paid for a lot of the equipment as well. So let's do some quiz questions for you. Don't forget, I will probably balls up some of these questions or edit them out. So here we go. Question number one, ladies and gentlemen. What was Joe's middle name? Question one, what was Joe's middle name? Question two, What borough was Joe born in? So what London borough was Joe born in? Question 3. What colour jumper was Joe wearing? Difficult question. Don't forget, if you get two or three of these, I'd be very impressed. Question 4. What is above the Coach and Horses pub? Amy, you should be able to get that one. That's an easy one. Question 5. What street did the second attack take place on? Question 6. How is Norman, the formidable former landlord of the Coach and Horses, described? So I drifted off then. Question 7. Which book was supposedly conceived and partially written in the Coach and Horses? Question 8. What did Muhammad Elneny train as? Question 9. What prison is Joe in? So question 9. What prison is Joe in? And question 10. What theatre does the murder scene back onto? So we're on Romilly Street. What theatre is that on the back of? Right, let's dive into some extra stuff. I'm gonna have to re-record it because it was hard to kind of get the rhythm of the poem because it's the kind of pentameter of it is kind of a difficult one for me, so I didn't quite get it right. But what I thought is I'd just read the words of the poem because I did actually take a lot out and I thought it was quite interesting. So here goes. This is An Odour Was All It Took. The smell of the cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, drug despair, oh how I wish I was there. School in the morning, football in the afternoon, painted circles adorned the walls of my room. Two cats and an apple tree in the garden. I struggled to place my memories. My memories have made my emotions harden. Self-reflection, soul inspection, toilet spoon, injection, adolescent withdrawals, abrupt erection. An outpouring of pain, shame, all aboard the thought train. This first paragraph. There's 5 in total, I believe. The smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, before prison, a colourless prism. Memories out of sync, anachronism, football stickers. Foil, pipe, light flickers. Soho-bound city slickers. Dark days, bright nights. A young moth down to Piccadilly lights. A corner huddled, seeking oblivion, memories muddled. A fruitless pursuit, trying to clasp a puddle that bubbled. An outpouring of pain, shame, all aboard the thought train. The smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, before heartache, theft and deception. Borrowed equipment, bloodborne infection. A broken back fence, an unlocked door, a trainer consumed by the fox left needing more, wanting more, always more, more. Unable to sedate a starving hunger. Full syringe, compressed plunger. Gone over while under, a meant blunder, and yet still an uncalled number. An outpouring of pain, shame, all aboard the thought train. A smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, before addiction. Was there a before? Before a need to score, a squat, a filthy floor, a runny nose, nausea, back pain. Feeding squirrels in Greenwich Park. Despise the light, but hate the dark. And the demons it conceals. Starving, yet can't stomach the thought of a stomaching meals. An outpouring of pain, shame, all aboard the thought train. The smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, before I made my mother cry. Earthbound, yet seeking the sky. My passage resides in a cling-filmed package. Emotions, memories, abandoned baggage. Blackheath fireworks display. Blackheath firework displays. Fairies sprinkling dust on school plays. The good old days. Before me and innocence parted ways. Waifs, strays, a cup in hand. Homelessness pays. An outpouring of pain, shame, all aboard the thought train. The smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, before fear, despair, a shed tear. Stealing from those I hold dear, near. My breaking point, suicide, life, what's the point? Institutionalised. A home in the joint, a home with a joint. Freedom and bound to disappoint. My core's rotten, I should be forgotten. An outpouring of pain, shame, all aboard the thought train. The smell of cut grass stained the air, evoking memories of a bittersweet childhood. A time before care, before lies, vacant eyes. A home open to the skies, flies, orbiting a shooting grage. Stranded on the strange with a strange handout for handouts. Spare change. A Christmas crisis. Mattresses made from the latest reports of ISIS. An odour igniting a forgotten history. Diluted memories, addictions, nothing but an enigma packaged in a mystery. An outpouring of pain, shame. Last stop for the thought train. It's a nice poem, that one. It's nice because it seems honest. It seems like he's. It doesn't seem like he's kind of saying, "Oh, woe is me." It's kind of, you know, there's kind of an honest resonance to it about, you know, the life he's kind of living and kind of wishing he could go back to the old days. The old days when it sounds like at some point in his childhood he seemed to have had a half decent life, and it seemed to be nice. But you know, becoming a drug addict at the age of 13. For him, it's kind of hard to come back to and hard to come back from, you know. You think about it, Joe's drug addict at 13, he's 34 years old, he was on drugs for 21 years. It's a hell of a long time. I thought I'd read some other interesting details. When I found Joe's poem, I thought that was quite interesting. I thought that was a nice way to explain his life. Joe used his own words. But while I was in there, I was going through a lot of the... Inside Time, which is the prison magazine you can get, and there was some interesting stuff in there as well. So there was an article by a prisoner called L. Gleason, who was talking about the smoking ban. So the smoking ban came in 2007, as mentioned, and he said, the government haven't got a clue. The prison system is failing. One of the reasons for so much reoffending is because there's very little to do here. So most prisoners turn to taking spice to take the days away. They ban smoking. And now, as a consequence, every prison is flooded with spice. And one of the reasons so many people go under on this drug is because without tobacco to dilute it, it is smoked pure. So what he's saying with that is, you know, in the old days, you'd use it as kind of something to jazz up your tobacco. But now, because they have no tobacco, basically everyone's just smoking it neat and becoming hopelessly addicted to it. So this is a major problem that needs to be resolved. The investigation I didn't go into too much in this episode because it was pretty simple. Detective Inspector Justin Harrick from Scotland Yard was overseeing it. Forensics were at the scene pretty fast. It was sealed off. It was a wet day, so obviously there weren't many fingerprints. Joe didn't pretty much touch very much. But if you look at the scene on Google Maps, you can go on there and have a look at it. Have a look at just all the cameras that are dotted around. Like, it's only a tiny street. It's a tiny street on Romilly Street that leads down to Cambridge Circus. So it's probably only about 100 feet long. But there's cameras everywhere because it's a high tourist area. And a lot of the premises have their own cameras as well. So there's at least 10 that I could see, but there's a lot more dotted around. Joe's arrest was pretty simple as well. As mentioned, he'd ran off to that other kind of other mentioned street. He'd stabbed the other 16-year-old, who is only mentioned in kind of one report. It was mentioned in the... it's not mentioned in any of the press reports, but I actually found it. I was going through the Court of Appeals paperwork, and it was actually mentioned in there, which is why I know a lot, because a lot wasn't written by the press, but the appeal, Court of Appeal, actually published a document which where a lot of this information comes from. Oh, what else have we got? There was, at the time that Joe was arrested, a 41-year-old woman was arrested with him. Almost nothing is said about her. We know her age, we know she's a woman, and that's it. She was later released, and that's all we really know. So we don't know what her purpose was, whether she was one of the other drug users that was there. Diving into the trial, as mentioned, the trial began. Boat going past too fast, not giving a shit, spilling my coffee everywhere. I'll have another swig. Trial began on 23rd of September 2019. It was a 2.5-week trial. What have we got? As mentioned, Joe pleaded not guilty to both of the serious charges, but he would later plead guilty to manslaughter on diminished responsibility for murder on diminished responsibility for the first charge, and manslaughter on diminished for the second. What was I going to go with? So two consultant psychiatrists gave expert evidence to the jury. As mentioned, so Dr. Farnham for the defence said that Joe was suffering from polysubstance dependent syndrome, a dissocial personality disorder, and cocaine psychosis. But Dr. Blackwood, who was called for the prosecution, diagnosed him, yes, with a personality disorder, but disagreed with Dr. Farnham as to the severity of the disorder and to the extent of Joe's dependence on drugs. Now, this is all quite important. So, as mentioned in the episode, the judge said the jury needs to keep an open mind. You know, there's going to be a lot of information coming forwards. Don't make up your mind at all until you've heard all of the evidence, especially from the psychiatrist, because he was saying this is really important. The evidence of the psychiatrist is important. This is what you're going to base all your information on. Obviously, they had to give all the information about, did Joe commit this crime? Yes, he did. But the whole crux of the case was it diminished responsibility owing to him taking drugs? Now, I kind of briefly mentioned this in the episode. I may have edited this out, but this became very important, and this is why it almost caused a mistrial. So, during the course of the trial, there were a number of notes that were sent to the judge from one of the jurors. One of the jurors, who was only ever known as the juror, obviously, as you go through the trial, the jury has a right to ask questions. When I was foreman of the jury, it was quite a self-explanatory trial. We really didn't need to ask for anything. We'd pretty much been given everything you needed to. But in a complicated case like this, you have the right to pass a note to the judge, and then the judge will kind of bring in the prosecution and the defence, and we'll ask them the questions. Then they will make the decision whether the jury will be given this information. So 26th of September, so this is like 2 days into the trial or something. Juror sent the first note, which asked 8 questions. The first 4 were related to aspects of the evidence which had been given, and these were uncontroversial. So actually neither defence or prosecution had a problem with that. But there were problems with questions 5 to 8. So the first one is diminishing responsibility morally right and conducive to protecting the general public and helping the defendant realise his crimes and giving the defendant the opportunity to come to terms with them, especially as in the case of the defendant, he has been sentenced for crimes of a similar nature on numerous occasions, 16 times according to the defendant. I am questioning the application of diminished responsibility in cases such as this. So this posed a problem because obviously the whole point of the jury is that they need to be impartial. The judge has already said you need to keep an open mind, but already that juror is saying, I am questioning the application of diminished responsibility after just 2 to 3 days. This is a 2.5-week trial. Question 6. This is not the quiz, by the way, because I've just said question 6, just in case anyone's getting freaked out. How do you objectively measure one's responsibility? To what degree should the defendant's responsibility be diminished? Good question, but also, you know, it's a hard question to answer. So, There's more of these, so I'm going to plough through. Question 7. What is the degree, what is the definition of addiction amongst the scientific community? Question 8. What is the objective diagnosis for discovering the presence of addiction in the human body? The judge allowed time for the counsel to consider this. At the start of the hearing on the following day, the 27th, Mr. Henry, for the defence, applied to the judge to discharge the juror. He submitted that despite the judge's clear directions that the jury should keep an open mind until they have made up their mind on all of the evidence, the juror had already formed an adverse conclusion and by the terms of questions 5 had displayed bias. The juror had not yet heard the evidence of the appellant, which is Joe, and either psychiatrist, but was questioning the application of diminished responsibility in this case. The juror was not dismissed at that point, and the application was rejected. What the judge did was quite rightly. He turned around and he made it clear to the jury that they need to make sure that they do keep an open mind in this case. Throughout, the jury retired at points. On the 30th, they retired, not fully, but they were permitted to retire for a time to go to a private room to read a bundle of medical records relating to Joe. Obviously, this is quite a complicated case, so that was quite rightly the right thing to do. 2nd of October... nearing the end of when Joe was given his evidence, that same juror sent note B to the judge, which contained 7 questions. The first was uncontroversial, but they were worried about the next 6. Question 2. It is true to say that the defendant has never made any sincere, willful attempt to cessate from drugs ever since taking the... Is it true to say that the defendant has never made any sincere, willful attempt to cessate from drugs since taking them in 1998? Meaning, has he ever really, really consciously tried to quit drugs? Question 3. Does the defendant feel a better person when he is taking drugs? They're objecting to this. There's a partial objection to this because it's like it's the juror saying, well, he's clearly enjoying when he's being on drugs. So surely that is a logical decision. But this goes against the idea of, you know, is he addicted to his drugs? Question 4. Why did the defendant need a knife when he confronted the second victim? I find that a baffling question. We kind of know he was robbing the guy, you fucking idiot. Question 5. Knowing the possible side effects and potential consequences of taking drugs at the time the defendant started taking them, and that he would still choose to take them despite the risks because they are enjoyable, does he not think his behaviour to be wholly irresponsible and demonstrable willful self-stupefaction? This juror is going to bug up his ass. This again was another problem because it's clear that the juror had already kind of made the decision that Joe is enjoying drugs. You know, less of it is about addiction, more of it is about his willingness to do this. It's not really he's not really asking an open question. He's putting across his own decision. It could be a she, I don't know. Question 6. Is this not a demonstration of the defendant taking control and dictating his own life? Question 7. Is the defendant not using addiction as an excuse in order to relinquish full responsibility of his crimes? Good question, but again, not a question for a member of the jury. That is really a question for the prosecution to answer. Not really those. So there was a bit of a big old conflab about this between the prosecution and the defence and the judge trying to work out whether it was kind of... Because don't forget, you can't just turn around to a juror and say, okay, you're out. You're out, because if you do that, you've got to restart the whole trial, which doesn't just mean going into the street and going, can I have some jurors coming in? It's a big old process. It's also... The prosecution and the defence have to restart everything, and then quite often they will rethink what they're going to put forwards as well, which sometimes can be a good thing for prosecution and defence, but sometimes it can be a really bad thing as well. Interestingly, when the jury returned with their verdicts, it was that same juror who acted as the foreman. We don't know anything about the juror slash foreman. As mentioned, the jury deliberated for 3.5 hours and they found him guilty of the charges, which was murder of Mohammed Elney and GBH with intent, which is a lower charge than manslaughter. He was convicted of both counts and sentenced to life with a minimum 30-degree term, eligible for parole November, technically November 2nd, 2049. As far as we know... Oh, is that a question? I think it is. I'm not going to say that one. Good. Well done, Michael. You've almost got away with not answering a question. Good. I could be a politician. So let's do the quiz questions and then I can have a little wee-wee. Lovely. Question number one. What was Joe's middle name? It was Derek. Derek. Every time I think of Derek, I always think of Bad Taste. Very good Peter Jackson film. One of his early ones. Possibly his first. Oh, well, not his first one, but one of his early ones. Who did Lord of the Rings, but this is where he came from. Question number two. That's not a quiz question. Question number two. What London borough was Joe born in? He was born in Lambeth. You've got to say it that way. Lambeth. There's no TH. You've got to be a F at the end. Question three. What colour jumper was Joe wearing? It was cream coloured. Question four. What... Oh dear. Question four. What is above the coach and horses? There is a vegan restaurant, which of course Amy is a fan of, because there they serve acorns and twigs, which is the daily staple of all vegans. That's a joke, people. Don't give me one star. You wrote that vegans like acorns and twigs. One star review. I would give a zero star review, but iTunes doesn't let me. I love when people write that. It makes me laugh. Question five. What street did the second attack take place on? It was University Street, which is just past Googe Street on the way to Warren Street. And it's near the scene of the Charlotte Street robbery, just over where the two men's coats were found, where they'd stashed them. Question six. How is Norman, the formidable former pub landlord of the Coach and Horses, described? He's described as one of London's rudest landlords. And there are many, trust me. Question seven. Which book was supposedly conceived and partly written at the Coach and Horses? It was The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And interesting, there's quite a wealth of books that were written and conceived in the area. Originally, I was going to do a tour years ago about authors and their inspirations, because you've got Bram Stoker, who worked as a theatre assistant over at Covent Garden, and that's where he met a Hungarian man who kind of gave him the original idea for Dracula. You've got Mary Shelley living not too far away over in King's Cross. Soho was also the inspiration for the picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. And it is said the kind of the debauchery was kind of based on the idea of kind of Soho and whatever pub was originally at the Coach and Horses. Also, there's a pub over in Fitzrovia. I think it's the Marquess of Granbury, which was the inspiration for Anthony Burgess to write A Clockwork Orange. Ooh. Question eight. What did Mohammed Elmi train as? What did Mohammed Elmi train as? A plumber. Question nine. What prison is Joe in? See, oh, I was right. What prison is Joe in? That's HMP Whitemore. Although he may have moved, as many prisoners do. Question 10. What theatre does the murder back onto? It is the Palace Theatre on Cambridge Circus, which was a regular hangout for a Dutch Lair. And it's currently home of the Harry Potter play. Ooh, exciting. Harry Potter. Good. That's that episode of Murder Mile. That was a bloody long record, Michael. That's going to be a pain in the arse to edit. Oh, shit. I've just made the page too small. Now it's got some... there we go. Good. Done. Right. That's me done. Hope you enjoyed that. Sorry, I'm just trying to... There we go. Done. I'm going to start editing this now and hopefully be done by Friday. Then I can go out with some chums and have some drinkies and maybe some pizza and stuff, even though I'm on a no wheat diet, but that will be my treat for the week. Good. Have yourself a good week, people. Stay safe. Be good. Lots of love. Be good. Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.